From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the most eclectic and emotional podcast around, certainly in sports business. As you'll have gathered, I'm not here with my fellow groundsman, Grant Williams, but you can hear the esteemed other groundsman, Captain Giles Morgan, chuckling away. How are you, my friend?
Rog, I'm very well. It's lovely to see your face and looking forward very much to this show.
Wonderful, wonderful. Tell me a little bit before we get into introducing the guests. You have been on your travels. You're back in the pole position for the World of Sports sponsorship. You've been in Hong Kong. Everybody, I guess, is laughing at your jokes again. Tell us a little bit about what's happening out in the world of sponsorship in Hong Kong.
Well, the Hong Kong Sevens, one of the sort of grandfather sports, certainly in the region, was celebrating the final year in the iconic stadium there in Hong Kong. And a lot of people came back, former expats, people who love the Sevens. And it was an enormous party. As always, the Hong Kong Sevens is a huge party, but it felt like it had got itself back. And it was a great muscle flex. I saw a lot of old friends. I was there as a guest of both HSBC and the Hong Kong Rugby Union, which was a great privilege, but also there representing Howden and with the British Lions next year. That was a very core audience of Asian expats who will be down in Australia next year. So a real privilege to be there and great fun too, I must admit.
Perfect. I think we're going to mention the Lions a little bit with our guests coming up and that part of the world and everything you were talking. So why don't we just get straight into it and you tell us who we have on the show that is today brought to us very kindly by Web3 Sport Ventures.
Yeah, Roger, I'm very excited with our guest this week, particularly because a lot of the stuff that you've been writing about in your columns on the Sunday column, talking about the value of shirt, of merchandise, and where that sits in the ecosystem of sport. And we're joined this week by Simon Rowe, who is Vice President of Sports Marketing at Pentland Brands. And not everybody may know Pentland Brands because it's kind of a house of brand type business. But my goodness, you'll know the brands that are within the business. Speedo, the world's leading swimming company, obviously. Canterbury Rugby Shirts, yep. LS in tennis, Berghaus Outdoor, and Mitre, the sort of iconic football yep. Of yesteryear.
Of my era.
Yep. And Endura. Of your era. And they have a brilliant business model. It's a privately owned business. And Simon is, I think, one of the real up-and-coming stars within our industry. He's been in it a while. He's a former head of global sport for each of the brands, actually, within Pentland, which means he has a very forensic knowledge of each brand. And I've got to work with him over the last few months with the British Lions sponsorship with Howden and Canterbury. And that has been really exciting because some of the things that I think I've learned from the podcast, we're hoping we'll be able to apply in how we go about our sponsorship activation in the next 12 months. So it's kind of a live case study, which I think I hope will be great fun. He also used to be sponsorship manager at the Welsh Rugby Union, which is quite a tough gig.
It is.
Welsh rugby may be passionate in terms of the fan base, but it's a country that is both small in population and economically challenged, which means there aren't big blue chip brands, which tend to be the preserve of rugby union. But I think that Simon was one of the key architects of one of the great sponsorships in Wales, which was the conversion of the name of the Millennium Stadium, which is what happened when that stadium was built, into the Principality Stadium, which yep. obviously is a name check to what Wales is as a principality, but more importantly to the sponsor, it's one of the main building societies in Wales, and it's become synonymous with Cardiff and with Wales, and Simon was very much behind that. He's also a dab hand at horse racing, I discovered, much to my irritation. I took him to Cheltenham. You couldn't come, so he became my silver medalist, and he won virtually everything, which was quite irritating. And all I ask, I beg you, Rog, is just don't ask for a pair of Speedos during the course of our chat with him, because
I don't think
it's something I can put. It's a mental image I can't live with.
Absolutely. No, that's great, because the sports apparel business is something that I've been having a little bit of a look at just now, mainly on the valuation side. Cantore, very chunky valuation with the Rain investment. And the Nike share price has come down quite a lot in this year. And obviously Adidas is being very active in all fronts. So why don't we wait no more and welcome Simon to Are You Not Entertained?
Simon Rowe, welcome to The Groundsman.
Wow, what an introduction. Thank you so much. And Giles, yeah, like you say, it's been a pleasure getting to know you properly over the last period with the relationship with Howden and Lions. You know, as you said, a veteran of the sports industry. And when you invited me on the show, what an interesting topic to cover. So hopefully I can do you some service on I suppose, the sportswear industry.
Lovely to see you. Thank you for coming on. And it's been a long time coming because we wanted to do this for a while. As you may or may not know, I'm very interested in the whole world from the business point of view, finance point of view of, if one can call it, the conglomerate model. I did an article a while back now on the MVMH of sport. I did an article on the Endeavour conglomerate. And, you know, obviously I knew Pentland before, but when I was doing the research for this, I just found it really interesting what you guys are doing. And, you know, I really want to actually be educated tonight a little bit about what is going on in this sector, because as we'll get into it, I think there's a lot of things that people don't understand so much anymore about, you know, the merchandise, the apparel sector of sport and where it fits in. So welcome.
Thanks, Roger.
The Olympic Games is coming up. I would imagine, therefore, for Speedo, one of your brands, that is a massive, massive opportunity. Give us an idea of how big the Olympics is, not just for Speedo, but just within the whole world of apparel and merch. How much does it move the needle every 4 years or every 2 years in winter, but basically every 4 years?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, this is my first Olympic cycle working across the Speedo brand, but as you can imagine, it's such a fundamental part of the sports ecosphere, for want of a better term. You know, we've all grown up loving the scale of the Olympics and, you know, the aspiration that it creates, seeing regular human beings as they are, you know, just like us, I can imagine, looking at you two gents.
Bless you.
We're all Olympians at heart. And it is a chance, right, to understand what physical activity can do. So for me, the Olympics has always been an aspiration to be part of. It showcases for brands, I suppose, an opportunity to really delve into a consumer that isn't maybe interested in sport on a 24/7 basis. And the reason I say that is because it starts to ignite the excitement with people. Big events really kind of capture the imagination. So for any brand that's involved in the Olympics, and let's not get into the cost of entry of entering into a partnership with the Olympics, but the principle of that moment in time is fantastic for brands, right? And I say that because I know that most organizations out there like mine are really trying to create a world of physical activity by product, right? So by making the right kind of product for people to participate either at an elite level or at a non-elite level, which is, let's be fair, us. So it will be a monumental time for the brand. To be clear, we're not a partner of the Olympics, but the interest levels are raised. Therefore, you know, the reason I'm out in LA, rightly so, is to understand what we're doing as a brand around the sport, which will have an increased, heightened level of interest at that time.
Speedo are not you're not part of the Olympics, but I would imagine, I don't know how many swimmers, athletes wear your product, but I'm going to suggest that the percentage is very high. So therefore, by definition, if you are interested in swimming, you're going to be very aware of the Speedo brand. How punitive are the IOC or the NOCs at the Games in terms of what you can and can't do, given that you are swimming has to be one of the big showcase events for the Olympic Games? Everyone knows that. And your apparel is there, and you're using it at the cutting edge with all those clever suits and stuff that people wear. But are they very punitive? Just give us a little insight of how do they police? How does it work?
Oh, it's a highly regulated Games for all the, I'd say all the right commercial reasons, because when you look at the money that the Olympic Games gets to reinvest back into sport, you'd say, look, there's rationale behind it. But the complexity of it is why, you know, why I've gone grey. Let's be fair. There are certain levels of, I suppose, rigor and restriction. Whilst I'm not a partner of the Olympic Games for the IOC, I partner with certain NOCs, like the Australian Olympic Committee. So we will create fantastically designed, as you call them, super suits. Unfortunately, not the same super suits that we had in 2008. I think we had 92% of gold medals were worn in Speedo, which was, you know, that's the scale of Speedo. And even since then, we're the biggest player in the sports, the swim sport world of performance. I think, and you're going to quote me on this, so bear with me because we're on record, but I think it's 62% of golds in the last Olympics were Speedo. So as you say, we're there. The athletes choose us. I have a huge portfolio across the globe of the best of the best. But the cost of entry in being an Olympic partner is reserved for those who have the right kind of funds and get that benefit from it. You know, the sportswear industry, I think if you told me you're going to sell me a package for the IOC, it just wouldn't be feasible. It wouldn't deliver the kind of benefits that we'd be looking for. And therefore, as a performance-based brand, the ask and the ability for me to be on those athletes at that moment in time is key, right? Because it helps to showcase innovation. It helps us to be credible at the right point in time. And equally, it helps if you think about the retail world, it helps us with our retailers so that they understand that the products that we make point us and deliver us in the right kind of sphere of quality and product. And that then goes through the whole range of product that we produce. Because as with everything, there's tierings. So you, and again, sorry, I'm calling you both out here, and I'm going to add myself into this world. I'm not going to be wearing fast skin product, because if you're wearing fast skin product, it would... it probably wouldn't represent what you want it to look like, I'm afraid, or us.
Simon, let me stay on this a little bit, and forgive me if this is the thrust of a lot of my questions, but I just think it's so important. What was the rationale for you guys already with a portfolio of brands coming up with the idea that Speedo was the right one to add to your portfolio? What was the assessment that you went through, both from a brand point of view and a financial point of view?
A really good question. It precedes me, but I'll try and give you some of the background. Obviously, Pentland Brands is a well-established business. And look, if you think about the history and you've done your research, you know, at a point in time, we... Reebok product in America. So we were I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this. We were one of the big investors in Reebok, which grew in the 80s, which was a true success story for Pentland Brands. And you look at the history of the family that own Pentland, and they have a real history of brand building. Now, if I think about the timing of this, and I can't remember the exact date when we acquired Speedo, but actually a lot of the brands in our portfolio have huge brand equity, but at a moment in time have either fallen off the radar of desire or importance, or I say in consumer importance. And the Rubin family would have bought Speedo back when I believe it wasn't in the best of health. And over the last period have driven it to be this global Goliath and behemoth of a sportswear brand. And that aligns with all the brands that we've acquired and brought into the portfolio. They're all brands with real rich heritage. And if you align them into this portfolio business that I know you want to talk through, it's how do you create and understand that consumer better? And across a portfolio of brands, across a portfolio of sports, that really kind of makes the decision easier as to which ones should be acquired and which ones should come into the portfolio. You know, it's great examples there. Speedo, you said before, Berghaus, Canterbury, Mitre, all historic brands that we, over the course of the last period, have really developed into these market leaders in their sphere.
That's a great answer. But if you allow me, in the role that you're in there just now, when you bring in a new brand, and I'm sure it's got its own management and its own brand thinking and strategy, you at Pentland, above the top of that, what work do you do to try and get some synergies, or do you leave them completely alone? You know, again, I'm thinking about LVMH and all that kind of thinking.
They'll all have their own brand identity, that's for sure, and they need to. The consumer doesn't want to see a whitewashed version of each of these brands. Otherwise, it just takes the soul and their individuality away from them. So in the time that I've been there, and I've been at Pentland for 8 years, we've acquired Endura, the cycling brand. So Scottish cycling brand, a fantastic, again, the two people that started that organization had a real drive to innovate in the sport. And that is what's quite key, actually, when you look at the acquisition, was what is it that makes them different and that therefore makes them suitable for the portfolio? And apologies, I'm going to go off track, but I promise I'll come back, is Speedo. I've talked about brand building, but Speedo is a brand with innovation at its heart. You know, all these sports, all these brands that we acquire, all of them have innovation at the heart. So it's that red thread that flows through everything that Pentland does and owns is what makes that decision quite simple. Now, the benefit of being a portfolio business, so coming back to your question, is actually scale. So what you've got there is actually the individuality of each brand. They don't run as separate entities per se. The brands will have their own brand team, but I sit, as Giles mentioned at the start, across all the Pentland brands. So there are certain central functions where you need that, skill set, that awareness and that ability to bring it together to benefit the scale of having more and more brands in the portfolio. And then actually the overarcher for me comes back to values and purpose. Again, Giles was really lucky to spend some time with our chairman, Andy Rubin, talking through the purpose and the values that we have as an organization. And what you get there is an ownership, the shareholders that are really into health and well-being. So I often ask myself the question, you know, why do we make product? Is it consumer goods? And the reason I love where I work is the values of the organization. So we're trying to help 100 million consumers live more healthy, active lifestyles. We're trying to improve the lives of a million consumers in their communities. And we're trying to be a net zero business. So everything we're doing is trying to move the dial in a positive fashion. And actually in a portfolio business, what that gives you is the scalability to be able to do that, because you have different differentiators between each brands, but you're all reunited behind a common goal.
Okay, that's super interesting. Let me continue a little bit more on that, because as an outsider, I see the apparel market for sport with some significant challenges. First of all, I'd like to say I really love that you guys are a private company. You're a big employer and, you know, still very much a British company. Just like Howden, actually, you know, one of the private companies in Britain that perhaps go under the radar and don't get the credit. So I'm saying this from a point of view that, you know, I know your brand, you've got LS, which we love here in Italy as a brand. Great, great possibilities there. But let me say this. I look at this sector of ours and I see a £120 England shirt. I see Castore Aston Villa, and then they say that technically it's not a good strip and it keeps the sweat and everything like that. I see clubs, rights holders seemingly squeezing the consumer by putting out third and fourth shirts that are perhaps nothing to do with what you call their brand identity. Leeds United were playing in pink when I saw them at Stamford Bridge. Help me get a little bit more optimistic about the sports apparel sector and why it is going to really help this whole ecosystem of ours move forward in some way.
Good. Great question. And look, one that I'm really, really excited to answer today, right? I won't comment on what my competitors or colleagues, however we want to describe them, their business model, but I can tell you why we do it, because I think that's really important. You made a point there, third or fourth kits. I used to the analogy the other day. Actually, I used the stat the other day. The Nigeria football kit. If you say Nigeria football kit to most people, they go, oh, it's brilliant, it's brilliant. You designed, I think from memory, I think they had 3 million pre-orders on the Nigeria kit. And what you find is there's a huge desire for rights holders to try and create commerciality in their apparel program. Right? It's a very simple, it's probably the easiest source of revenue because it's the incumbent. You can't play sport without it, right? And that's a fundamental. Whereas I'm looking at Giles and I'm thinking, if the Lions didn't have an insurance partner, then the world doesn't stop turning. They need a front of jersey partner. Great. But you need an apparel partner. And you're going to forgive me for going on a bit of a long story here, but I think we've got enough time, hopefully. But if I even think back to when I first joined the industry, my world was very much a supplier. It's a necessity product. And therefore, in that sense, you know, your commercial directors, your commercial teams would go, right, well, we need a supplier, so let's get X amount of kit from this partner. And it became quite transactional. And I still believe to this day, there's a certain element of rights holders that don't really understand the ability of brands to grow their own brands or the desire of brands to grow their own brands. But we were suppliers. So in that nature, your point about the £120 England kit, look, we will have a highly expensive Lions jersey that will be available to buy. That's a fact. We'll also have the smaller priced or the cheaper priced items that hopefully will engage younger fans in the sport. Because the 100 plus jersey that we hope people are going to buy is actually the piece of equipment that the team are going to wear. So there's a necessity in there. So there's a huge range. And if I could take you through it, and I can't because it's highly confidential, but it's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. And Giles hopefully will testify to this. The range needs to be built fit for purpose. That international team that will tour Australia need to be wearing the best product. Therefore, innovation, come back to the conversation, we will create a range for the team. Due to, and it's not cost of living crisis, just the cost of goods, especially as an organization that's focused on responsible sourcing, sustainability, product doesn't come cheap. If it comes cheap, it's probably come from the wrong source, because it's probably not sustainable and it's probably not the items that you want, to your point about non-moisture wicking. So therefore, you've got a range of products that is supplier-led innovation that is for performance, because what we want is the Lions to win. Because of the sourcing model, it makes sense to sell that product. And to super fans like myself, like Giles, hopefully like you, you go, actually, you're the consumer that will probably invest in something that is just what the players wear. But then you've got this whole ecosystem of, well, I don't need to wear what the players wear because, unfortunately, I'm not the shape of Sam Warburton or Justin Tipperick or whoever. I now need to have a supporters range. And again, it becomes a revenue source for these rights holders that as they start to develop in their mindset around, okay, the commerciality of the program, I can see that consumers are asking me for more and more products. And I can see that my consumer base is, you know, I can open the door. And actually, let's pick Canterbury as an example. Canterbury, you're there. I need to get some money out of you because you're gonna supply the product for the fans and for the kit. So I'm gonna charge you for that privilege. I'm absolutely gonna charge you for that privilege. And as this sports ecosystem gets bigger and more sophisticated and salaries go up and cost of analysts and GPS systems and stadia and Wi-Fi, unfortunately, there's a cost base that's needed for rights holders that we bear the brunt of. And when you say bear the brunt of...
Wow, that is a great line.
It's what it is, effectively. You know, there's a cost of business that somebody needs to fund if we want performance to be where it is. And look, it's not lost on me, without giving any commercial information around the Ireland jersey. But I used the stat with somebody the other day, and I can't remember who, and I hope it wasn't you, Giles. But you look at the Lions, and you look at the concept of the Lions. There's 4 home unions. And I think I came out with the statistic that there's more jerseys sold in a Lions jersey than the 4 home unions combined. And that wasn't actually the point. It was somebody turned around and said, well, obviously England's the biggest. And you go, well, no, Ireland. Because guess what? Performance breeds desire. And that performance breeding desire means that you've got more and more fans that want to be associated with it. And therefore you grow your program. So success breeds this ecosystem. But for success, and this is why, apologies, I have gone on far too long. But
no, this is crucial.
But this success costs money. Again, it won't be lost on anyone. If you watch the 1997 Living with Lions tour, there was a handful of backroom staff. I'm looking at the next tour, and there's a likelihood that you've probably got as many backroom staff come in as you have players, because you need the nutritionist and you need the analyst and you need the physiotherapist. And that's all because performance is key. All comes at a cost.
Well, there's so much to break down there. And if Giles allows me, because I know you two speak a lot regularly, so this is my only chance, really. I want to come back on a couple of things there. The first one, I think I want to agree with you fully. In recent months, maybe years, one of my biggest issues with the sports rights holder side of our industry is what we call the minimum guarantee culture, which is basically with all the partners, and I guess you would be one of them, it's put down a cheque and frankly, I'll see you at renewal time and I'm sure you'll make money out of that. Now, I think that's not good enough for our industry. I think it's the source, this search for top line revenue is perhaps not in the best interests of the consumer. And whilst I would say this, when we're talking about the Lions, everybody wants to buy that jersey. Everybody wants to buy that jersey. I can't find a way to understand why they're asking Leeds United supporters to buy the fourth kit in pink. That to me seems to be sport taking advantage of loyal fans. So, you know, the minimum guarantee thing, I wonder how long that can last from both sides, because I think smart sports organisations will get much more into a risk-sharing attitude. But equally, they may try to do it themselves, like Barcelona says it's thinking of doing. I don't necessarily believe that, but they're starting to talk about it. And then guys like yourself, you're going to say, look, I'm not just putting down that minimum guarantee. I want partners. I want you, whether it's the FA or whether it's the Welsh Rugby Union, I want you guys to have a partnership where we do the best for our sport and the fans. And today I just don't see it that way. And that's why you end up with £120 shirts, because, you know, you're having to recover your minimum guarantee.
If you don't mind, I might challenge you just on one of the points. I'm going to add you on a few others. Leeds with a pink fourth shirt should be down to your consumer insight. Should be. Right, and I can't comment for, I think it's Adidas that are with Leeds. If you think, and again, the conversation myself and Giles have had over the course of the last few months, is you've got a range that's designed for a consumer base, as in a Lions consumer. Now, hopefully, and rightly so, if you said, who is a Lions consumer? Depending on who you ask, will tell you it's a different consumer. So a Lions tourist is generally somebody aged, let's not get into ages actually, but it's somebody who's more affluent that can afford to go on tour, and therefore you need a product that's fit for purpose. And the amount of times I've had a conversation where, well, you have to have a classic jersey, because guess what? A classic jersey is classic rugby. Now, us as an organisation, when I think of Canterbury, we're trying to create a sustainability for the sport. You know, we need to raise the water because a rising tide lifts all boats. And therefore, what we're trying to do is trying to make sure with rugby that it's more accessible. And I come back to a stat. I sit on a board, the WFSGI, so World Federation of Sporting Goods Industry. I sit on the Physical Activity Committee. There is a stark statistic that 81% of adolescents don't do the requisite or enough exercise as recommended by the WHO. So everyone is desperately trying to ensure that they're connecting with this younger consumer to get them physically active. Because if we don't, it's not just about fitness and sport. It's about non-communicable diseases. It's about cost on the economy. So all the sports brands, and this is where I will put my arms around our sports brand, my sports brand colleagues, are desperately trying to create opportunities for people to get active. So therefore, come back to the Lions conversation. If I just made a classic red jersey, an 18-year-old is not going to be interested. Let's be fair. They want something that's more akin to what they would wear. And that's what creates the breadth in a range that I don't understand Leeds' strategy, but that's why I would challenge you on the pink jersey, is there's got to be consumer demand for it to be created. And therefore, is it is it trying to take advantage of consumers? I'd like to say no. I'd like to say it's just segmenting your consumer base.
Given that you work with rights holders, but you're selective with the rights holders that you work with your Pentland brands, depending on which of the sports, etc. And something that Roger has been leading the charge on really for the last 4 or 5 years about the rights holders perhaps not knowing their fan and consumer base not nearly well enough. Would you two be in an echo chamber of violent agreement on that? That really, that you look at many of the rights holders that you work with and realise they just don't know the fan as well as they should. And assumption being the mother of all fuck-ups, isn't that the biggest problem in the sports industry right now? Is too much assumption, not enough knowledge? My words.
There's always, yeah, your words. There's always great examples and terrible examples. I would say as a broad statement, yes, you're broadly correct. I'm in the benefit again of working across Pentland brands, so I see the best and the worst of rights holders across different sports. You know, I have the benefit of that foresight. There are some out there who are fantastic and who are really considering who their consumers are, and they're really trying to either grow their sport, grow the consumer, understand their consumer, and then deliver it to their partners. There are others out there who are walking blindly and naively into, well, it's on TV and I know I've got you on the hook because if it's not you, it's one of your competitors and therefore it's one of your other competitors and I can drive the price because I know you need it. And I look at the portfolio that I've created with Pentland Brands of partnerships and I'm really proud of the fact that they're either rights holders that understand the consumer or are trying to understand the consumer and trying to deliver that for us. Because again, I could give you some horrible examples of negotiations where I've walked into a room and they've gone, well, you just need to pay this fee. And you try and ask them to value or evaluate the valuation and they go, because one of your competitors will pay it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
who's my, and I think that's a challenge for our industry. I think of almost as a I'm going to say this word terribly, proliferation.
Well done.
It's Sunday, guys, so bear with me. Proliferation of opportunities of rights holders that have been created out of this world of increased broadcast, increased opportunities, increased distribution. That there's so many. If you saw my inbox of rights holders that approach and say, I've got the greatest next tiddlywink competition and I think you would want to sponsor us because, and their first comment is not around their consumer, it's because of the cash that they need to fund their organization.
I think that's the key of it that I was going to say earlier, because it's driven by the minimum guarantee culture. First of all, Giles is 100% correct. Most of us, and I'll put me on the side of the sports industry, don't know the fans well enough. So the idea that the pink shirt is because somebody's done a whole lot of research and there's a whole lot of females or people that like that colour, I just don't buy that at all. I just wonder who really is working on the product market fit in the apparel business, because there's too many bad examples out there, Simon. You know, some of the football strips that are put out there today are just horrendous. And you may say, well, I would say that because I'm no longer 17, but they are just horrendous. And then you see even today at the Masters, you know, Jason Day have been told by the patrons to remove that sweatshop Marlborough or something like that. There seems to be a whole lot of people in the sports apparel industry that have had their sense of good taste medically withdrawn. I'm not including you in that, but because your brands, I know the ones they are, and they're not. But the general ones that are going around. Maybe it's because I'm in Italy, but even there's some horrible stuff here. You know, look at Sinner, the tennis player Sinner. In Monte Carlo, he changed his outfit to the black one for Nike. The one he's been wearing before, where he's won all his titles, is a horrendous Nike outfit. It's truly horrendous when you think of yourself, Sergio Tarquini, all the old... So where is this lack of taste coming from, Simon?
I'm going to ask you a rhetorical question. You've noticed them.
Oh, don't tell me that. So, don't tell me that. This is deliberate?
look, you're trying to capture the imagination of a consumer. So you'd like to, and listen, there's always example after example, and there's not one rule fits all. But if I go back to a comment that somebody made to me the other day, and look, these are friends who understand the industry I work in, and they'll talk about the fact that, I don't know, Arsenal is an Adidas team. And they go, I wouldn't buy an Arsenal shirt if it was Macron. And you go, yeah, you would. Of course you would. Right? Because you actually wouldn't notice. And this is a key industry point that really is quite a link back to my comment about being a supplier. There are teams, there are organizations that we have partnered with for, I would say, extended periods. Then when you do your insight into the consumer that you're going after, so generally like football, rugby, tennis, whatever it may be, and say unprompted awareness of the kit manufacturer, and you're in the low digit figures, and you think, well, why did I spend all that money if nobody is even noticing we're there? And actually the cost, you're going to hopefully nod at this point as well, because the cost of entry of partnership is so high, it limits your ability to activate them.
100%.
Because you need the money in both senses. So a rights holder either wants to take the cash, get the kit, doesn't really matter who it is, off we go. Or the savvy rights holder, and this is where I do feel there are good operators out there, are the ones that understand that you have an ability to connect with their consumer in more ways than anyone else does, because nobody wants to... I'm going to use an example of England rugby, but it could be anyone. You know, it's like dad, right? Dad's telling me that I've got to do this. Whereas cool brands such as Nike, such as Adi, such as us, all the whole portfolio, I would say, have actual ability to be one arm's removed from the rights holder and can connect with them in a societal way. So to your point about the T-shirt that you've seen on Cinna that you don't like, at least you've noticed it. So you start to have an opinion on that brand. And that brand is probably trying to be disruptive because they're trying to change the industry. There's probably an element of them trying to create some commerciality from it. Why not? That's, you know, we work and live in a commercial world. But I would suggest that the response that you've got to the product is because A, you're probably not the target market for it. But B, the younger consumer, you've got to try and find a way of capturing their imagination. Ultimately, we're in the commercial world where we're trying to create sticky customers. You get aware of this brand, you might dislike or like what they're doing, but suddenly we've got your attention. And by getting your attention, you're actually taking it away from Giles's point, which is the rights holders don't have that consumer data. So suddenly I've got an opportunity to connect with them, and I can build in, I can create a community with them. So they might have hated the black T-shirt or they might have loved it, but I've engaged them in some way that then hopefully I can bring them into my world of database and consumers and communities and start to personalize and start to really connect with them. Because otherwise, I'm just an apparel manufacturer.
I get that. And I think, again, it's a really important point. This, I'd put it under the heading, sport isn't able to really know its customer and do segmented marketing. So it'll be guys like you that do it and take that opportunity. I hear you in that. But let me continue a little bit with these younger audiences. And you know, I've got two kids around the 20 age. What do you think is, you know, you see all this crossover now, you know, Michael Kors and sport. I'll give you another example. I met a couple of days ago the head of Mercury 13, the fund that's buying women football teams, and they've just bought Como as the first one, which is a huge coincidence. And I was speaking with her, and she basically has got a vision where, you know, every club that they buy and the multi-club strategy they've got will represent a different brand for a different audience, a different type of woman. You know, some might be of a certain age and a certain disposable income and a certain style. Others might be a bit more grungy. Others might be, you know, LGBT and things like that. So people are thinking, it's not the sport that's doing this, it's people outside it that are starting to put together the segmentation of audience with products. And, you know, When you're doing that, how do you think about all these kids that are spending so much money on virtual goods and digital props? And, you know, even our great friends at Web3 Sport Ventures, they've got all this kind of like merchandise that's in some way digital. How does that fit into your strategy?
Yes. And I'm pausing on the question because I think it's quite a broad one. So apologies.
It's a bad question if it's too broad.
I actually can't think how best I'm going to articulate the response here, because if we think about, segmentation, market segmentation, I think your point was around more like it's up to brands that are trying to segment, you know, and partnerships that then try and capture the imagination of different consumers. So I would say your question is probably more framed around the fact that there's, kind of back to one of your other points, that sports rights holders aren't sophisticated enough, and so brands are taking it upon themselves to do so. I agree. Like, we need to work with our rights holders on opportunities that really can connect with the consumer. And I think you talked about collabs, so that's why I'm hesitating somewhat, because we engage in collabs when you understand that there is a crossover between a brand identity that really, and I'm going to use the industry terminology, resonates with that target consumer. I've actually got myself into a really good space with our ambassadors, where actually they're becoming a bit more sophisticated than some of the bigger rights holder team rights holders, because the athletes alone, their channels are becoming so phenomenally engaged that you can start to do crossovers with athletes and brands. So that's another opportunity and another rights holder. You've then got brands that go out and do their own thing, like Red Bull. You know, let's try and avoid the world of understanding through a third party who the consumer is. I'm just going to go and find it myself, and I'll do so by creating and running my own events. So I think I'm answering the question with one of my own, which is, I think sports rights holders have opportunities to connect with consumers in a different way. I think the world of sports apparel, and if I fast forward 10, 15 years, sports apparel effectively becomes a vehicle. It becomes a technology vehicle, hopefully, for a broader audience. I remember when I was at Welsh Rugby Union working with the Under Armour team, and they talked about their sports category not being apparel, but being tech, because the apparel is just it's almost like a housing vehicle for technology, for innovation. And if I fast forward to 10 years' time, actually, I think about, you mentioned the Web3 Sports Ventures, opportunities to really connect in a digital way with the consumer, because, you've got me on a monologue now. So again, forgive me.
No, this is great. This is great. This is a really important, Simon.
Yeah, you go into a stadium, right? And I think the phrase that I hear more than anything is, right, we need to create and understand our communities. But people are looking for personalization. People are looking for experiences. Now, if you're a rights holder and you have a stadium that's 40,000-seater capacity, you really know what your revenue streams are from that rights holder, from the ticketing program. And therefore, only the select few can engage in that experience in a personal, I was there manner. So you're limiting the site of your scope if you're just going down the route of, I need to sell them tickets. And at the same time, I'm going to open a club shop and I'm going to sell them merchandise. And I'm going to open a digital shop, and hopefully those fans that are watching on TV, they're going to buy some merchandise as well. And it's the archaic model, and it limits the site of a rights holder scope. So you go broader and you think about the future and say, there are global communities. As the world gets more global, as fans get more, I suppose, disparate across the globe, actually, you know, again, you mentioned Web3 Sports Ventures. How do you connect those consumers? Because ultimately, you're trying to create communities. Now, I would say that's incumbent on a rights holder to try and do so. But what a great opportunity is the one thing that they really need to show their allegiance. You know, it's a physical manifestation of who they are as a person, is a jersey or a beanie or a cap or a whatever it may be. So actually working hand in glove, hand in whatever you want to call it with your apparel partner can really open opportunities to connect with that new consumer.
I completely agree. And that's why I started saying, you know, help us, you know, take this opportunity as an industry, because I just don't have a lot of faith that the guys and girls my side of the table are sophisticated enough to do it. So, you know, that's why it makes me quite angry that if you know you're not good enough, you find the partner that is, and you don't have a minimum guarantee attitude towards them that says, put your check down and good luck making money. You know, I would be saying, help me get to other audiences. Where is the crossover? You know, there's a whole subculture now about sneakers in the US. Is that going to become a thing with jerseys as well? And if it is, can we start making things that are nice? Because, you know, people that, I don't know whether you like this guy or not, but people that say it's just a vehicle for technology. What you wear is how you present yourself to the world. It needs to look good, Simon. It really needs to look good. And I just think some of the stuff that out there, I can't explain it, because there must be two people that are tangoing to come up with something really that's not great. You know, I don't understand how we get through this and how we stop fleecing the customer with four strips and we get back to less is more. You know, I'm going to be buying that Lions jersey regardless what it costs, because it's important. We all love the Lions. And I'll do the same for other things. You know, if Speedo come out with a product that is for somebody of my age and my physique, I quite like that brand and I'd probably buy it, you know, but I can't buy, you know. So anyway, I'm the one doing a monologue now.
You can, Rog. Don't be so modest. You can buy that brand. You can go absolutely as tight as you like. And I tell you what, your audience now, having read your book, the next thing they want is Roger in proper Speedo,
that's not
bright
happening.
Red.
That's not happening.
It's true.
It's not happening.
I know it.
You did say at the start, Giles, that Roger would ask and he wouldn't get. But I'm more than happy for Roger to be a test model for some of our Speedo product.
Because now that is a photo call I'll come to.
But you, ultimately, as any brand, you want to get your product in the hands of the consumers, because they're your biggest fans and or evaluators, biggest critics at the same time. Like more product in more hands.
Obviously, being, and you talked about it, felt like, I've just watched the Ferrari film on the plane coming back, and Enzo Ferrari's dedication to being absolutely all about being high quality, being the very best engineer, and all of that comes through, and clearly the brand that was built is extraordinary. How does it work in Speedo land, where you've got these extraordinary athletes wearing the suits, they are competing at the Olympic Games or all of the championships? How does that correlate down to the consumer, which for, I know that the sort of the swimming organisations talk about swimming being one of the highest participation sports in the world, but the truth is it's not. People swim, but they, and will tick that on some survey, but they're not competitive swimmers. How do you bridge that gap between not so much the suits, but what is clearly a performance garment through to someone like me that might want to go to the beach and go for a swim? How do you cross that? Why does a top swimmer therefore talk to someone like me as someone who likes to go for a swim? How important? Because you talk about performance at the highest level, but clearly the money is made by selling a lot of garments.
And look, swimming is the only sport that can save your life. So to your point, it's the only sport that can do so. But there is there's a massive difference between Adam Peaty in Fastkin product and Giles going for a swim, you know, for fitness and or just because, you know, maybe you're taking children to the pool and the like. But what we're working on again is this phrase around communities. So Adam Peaty might not inspire you to get in the pool. There was a conference I was at a little while ago where there's a really interesting stat that Gen Z are more disassociated with elite sports than ever before and than any other generation. In fact, they really don't feel inspired because those athletes are so far removed from reality for them that it becomes something of a lack of interest. And therefore, what you do is you, as an organization like ours, find the areas in which they are interested. So different communities don't need to be elite sport. And coming back to my point about the disparate global nature, I think there was a conference. It sounds like I went to lots of conferences and I didn't. But there's a conference where I was listening to a speaker really engage in what does it take to, or what's the human spirit, or what's the human emotion that's most important? And it's that feeling of belonging. And so feeling of belonging is what we do as an organization. You're trying to create communities. So elite level sport creates a performance-led pathway for those athletes or future athletes that want to perform like Adam Peaty or want to perform at their best. But by creating communities around outdoor swimming, so wild water swimming at the moment is very high topic in terms of mental health. So Speedo Outsiders Club becomes a vehicle for us to really talk to a different consumer about different areas. So, you know, Speedo's our biggest global brand that we have in the portfolio. It has a massive market segmentation. And yeah, you're right. Adam Peaty, if I stick him on a pair of Endurance Plus water shorts, it's kind of a bit disconnected. So actually, you just find different ways to connect with the consumers that actually engage in that way. Sorry, a lot of jargon there, but it hopefully makes sense in terms of what our product creation would be. And look, goggles are a fundamental part of most people swimming. We all hate getting water in our eye. So that would transcend through from an elite swimmer to somebody who's out swimming the Serpent, which I'm sure you do, Giles.
Not every week.
Simon, I've got another question, which you probably get an idea that I'm a bit of a traditionalist and all this kind of stuff about style and brands as well. I'll give you an example. You guys have got Mitre. Mitre, for my generation, was the only ball. I'm talking the only ball. And then when I started to get involved in sport in the 90s, like all our generation, Nike started trying to get the rights for the Premiership ball in England. I think they did succeed that. And all hell broke loose. All hell broke loose. I remember it well. Because the ball wasn't good enough. It just wasn't good enough. So, you know, when you guys have got Mitre now, and you see what's out there, give us an idea of the kind of thought process you go about and saying, how do we get back to, let's say Britain at least, that in Britain in the 60s, any serious football team was using a Mitre ball. How would you try and get back to that retro dominance of the brand market?
Mitre is one of our sleeping giants, and I don't mean that in a bad way to Mitre. In fact, it's not sleeping at all. The FA Cup partnership is, you know, is a great example of an organization that looked at performance as a key characteristic. So when I said at the start around the partnerships that I'm proud of, where they think more aligned to what does the consumer want, that is a great example of that. I mean, there's no hiding behind the fact that Mitre and the Premier League, when you talk about the Premier League, and I'm smiling because you're the same, I would say we're on a similar era of, I watched the Premier League growing up, and there's so many moments in time of whether it be David Beckham, whether it be Eric Cantona, whatever it may be, you've got that Mitre ball central to that moment in time. Your whole premise of this podcast talks about rights holders and evaluation of sports rights. There is a arm wrestle, a tussle between, I call them the big three if you want to, that are going to want to fight for rights around Premier League, around Champions League, that would just prohibit a brand like Mitre really investing in it and succeeding, because you've got to globalize the whole market for footballs to be able to really justify the spend. And I would argue that with some of these rights holders and some of these moments in time, it does become an arm wrestle. It's a, I guess it's a trophy on a shelf. I've got that one. I think you mentioned in one of your articles or one of your columns around Nike taking the German football deal, you know, and spending a fortune on doing so. But that is that's an opportunity for a brand to disrupt and to go in and fight against each other for rights. Now, I wouldn't want to do that with Mitre, because I think what it would do is it would devalue what we're trying to achieve. You've mentioned it. Everyone grew up loving Mitre, and therefore I need to find opportunities for people to love Mitre. And to the point I made on the Speedo comment earlier about local and communities becoming closer knit into your local environment, therefore I focus on what is real football. So the FA Cup is a prime example of real football. Anyone can make it to Wembley. any one of those teams from Accrington, Stanley, Wrexham, whoever it may be, can find their way to Wembley. It stands true to our purpose. And I activate with the right consumers in the right way, rather than getting into some kind of egotistical conversation around, I need to have it just because. Because if I can't do anything with it because I've spent all my money on the rights fee, there's no point in doing
That's
it.
That's fascinating. So, fascinating, Simon.
The likelihood of you seeing Mitre back on a Premier League pitch in terms of the Premier League ball, be very slim at the moment.
No, but look, I know
other
that.
Opportunities to
I know that. And this plays into the theme, which has always been my theme about this polarisation into Hollywood sport. We'll just call it football just now because we're on Mitre. Hollywood football and what I call community local football. What you said about the FA there is just it's great thinking. Why wouldn't you go after the EFL as well? And try and do a deal with them because they their future is all going to be around, you know, we are the local football from your local community. It's the way Serie B is in Italy as well. You know, make it an advantage to be not Hollywood. Say Hollywood is fake and artificial and real sport, real football is at the EFL level, the FA Cup level, Serie B, even the Scottish leagues where there's 40 clubs. I'm sure they would be very interested in that. But I get the impression you're already thinking like this, Simon, and there's nothing I'm saying that you're not already thinking about.
No offence, Roger, but yeah, absolutely. I'd evaluate, you've got to align the brand to the right opportunities. And we had a 42-year partnership with the EFL. And we've had partnerships with the SPFL for years, and we'd always entertain a conversation with the rights holders that want to think in that way, that would give us opportunities to connect with their consumers and do it in the right manner, and activate the grassroots of football. You know, it's great when you get external validation of leagues or clubs or teams doing something in the right way, and we'll always evaluate them. We might not secure them because there's always a commercial conversation that happens, but the benefit of working for an organization like Pentland and a business as we are is we're trying to do the right thing. So I know you're frustrated with the industry, and I can see it and I can appreciate it, and there will be good players and bad players, but as an industry, it is challenged. You know, it's the squeezed middle. Everyone wants more products. Everyone wants more fee. The cost of goods has gone up. You know, imagine the impact of the Evergreen getting stuck in the Suez Canal on supply chains and the like. The ensuring that you're aligned to positive business objectives and responsible sourcing means that, I come back to that point that I made earlier, cost of product goes up. So you are the squeezed middle, but you're there for the right purpose. Or certain organisations are, like mine. Obviously, I wish it was
I'm
mine.
Very optimistic about this, in it for the right purpose. Don't necessarily think about maximising revenues, making sure you're doing the right thing with authenticity. I think that's sport's future, the principle of scarcity. Forget this top line chasing, which all we really do is made players and agents rich by going after these minimum guarantees and just going for short-termism. I really hope, and this is why I wanted to do this podcast, that smart people like yourselves, and I have looked a lot at your site. I mean, you've got a section of your site that talks about slavery. You know, you've got sections on your website that, I mean, this isn't a normal organisation. You're not out there chasing the big public market valuations, you know, all the stuff that's out. I won't go into names and everything like that, but I'm not bullish on a lot of the valuations that some of your competitors have got. So, you know, I think that we should celebrate what you're trying to do. And if there's anything I can personally do, I've still got some decent contacts, certainly up in Scotland, to get Mitre back where it should be. I will try and do that for you in any way I can.
Thank you. No, look, it's I said at the start, Pentland Brands and the Pentland Group is just not an outlier in the industry, because I'd like to think our colleagues across the industry are trying to do the same thing. That's not to say that certain organisations might look at things differently, but, you know, we're all in this together. We're all trying to do the same thing. And, you know, my personal objective in being in the role that I'm in is to create great partnerships that allow our potential consumers to engage with rights holders, to buy the right product, and look, I'm coming out with every piece of hyperbole that you could imagine for our industry. But there's a goal there that we are trying to ensure that the next generation has a lifestyle that they should, which is physically active. And with sportswear brands, with sports equipment manufacturers, it's pretty implicit in the title that we're trying to enable people to get physically active. It's not generally meant to be there to just make commercial return for shareholders and stakeholders' interests. And kind of that's why I appreciate your point around looking at our site, and it's really clear our ownership is really focused on health and well-being.
Well, in closing, I'd like to say, and with Simon, who I am working with on the Lions, with his brand of Canterbury and Howden, who are the shirt sponsor, I don't think there will be many examples when we look back in a couple of years of an insurance broker and a sportswear manufacturer working so closely together. In the old days, that would just never have happened. You'd think totally different customers, totally different business needs. But we've come together because we both have one thing in common, as anybody involved in the world of sport should have, which is there is a customer base out there, and we need to know who it is, because if we get that right and we engage with those customers, even though Simon's customers are clearly different from ours, we can both benefit together. And the tripartite agreement that we're trying to work together, if we get this right, and there's a lot of work being done behind the scenes now, I think we'll give a quite an exciting green channel to the industry to see where there is opportunity for all of us. Because with this podcast that Roger and Grant started, gosh, nearly
Andrew,
5 years
Giles,
ago.
Giles, you should stop saying
and,
that.
And me, I came in as a Johnny come lately. But sometimes I get asked, you seem that you're aggressive on the sports industry. What your book, certainly Roger does, and anyone who knows Grant, is there are no bigger fans of sport, and no one who wants to see the world of sport go to the places where we believe it should. We all, and Simon, you being that, and many of our listeners, we're all massive fans of the sports industry. We know it quite well, but we're also frustrated. I think that where Pentland are going, the way that you're approaching things is absolutely maybe an exemplar that will help the industry. And from that point of view, I am looking forward to two things. One, we can obviously get Roger one of the more comfortable Lions shirts in due course when they're out later on in the year, as well as the tartan Speedo that I know that you'll have lurking. Because I don't know, I've just got this image, and it's on a Sunday evening. It's Masters weekend. I need some good cheer, and that gives it to me.
Absolutely. And in return, Simon, seriously, you said you don't go to many conferences. If you can find your way to ours in Como, that would be really wonderful, because I think everything that you're saying fits very well. Also because, we are quite strong on branding and image and doing things probably with a higher level of quality than is the mean. So if you can find your way to Como on the 19th and 20th of September, try and come and see us, Simon.
That'd be great. Thank you. No, I appreciate it. It's been such a good chat. Like, it's a good opportunity to really kind of understand and share with industry professionals what motivates brands. And, as I said at the start, I can't talk for my competitors, nor should I. I can tell you what we do at Pentland Brands. And what I love about what we do is it has purpose. And everything I've said to you today, we can stand behind as an organization. And let's fast forward 10 years to Giles's point. There's so much we're trying to achieve on the Lions. There's so much we're trying to achieve with the Olympics. There's so much we're trying to achieve across other events, whether it be mountain biking, downhill, or FA Cup. You'll hopefully now see, when you trace the Pentland Brands activity, a real red thread. And that, if you come back to me in September and tell me that you see that red thread, then that is job done.
Good for you, Simon.
Well,
really,
Simon,
encouraging.
Have a very safe flight to Los Angeles, and we'll look forward to seeing you on your safe return, having nailed your Olympic strategy for this year, later on in the year. But in the meantime, thank you very much for joining us on The Groundsman.
Thank you,
absolutely
Simon.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Well, Giles, that was really fantastic. Can I apologise for monopolising that? But it was the kind of conversation that I just love to have. It's when I don't know too much about a sector and you find somebody that does, I just tend to get a little bit excited about asking them and try and educate myself. And I thought he was really amazing.
Well, it's good, you know, Rog, you write a lot of your Sunday columns, I know, getting a lot of traction and a lot of interest. And I obviously read them and we talk about them offline. But sometimes you come up with things, you poke the bear, or you're looking to explore some areas either that you don't understand and that you want to understand, or doesn't make sense to you and you want to have explanation. And I think I knew that Simon would be able to explain his industry in a way that will make sense to people. They're a smart business that are trying to make smart money through the value of both participation, authenticity, and sensible consumerism. So for me, that's the perfect show in a sense, because I think people have a view that sometimes you'll be sizing up for a fight. Actually, knowing you as I do, it's more you're sizing up for someone to explain something that may not make sense to you. And that will either make sense to you or it won't. But at least people have the right to a proper explanation. And Simon is, as I say, what we're doing with the Lions and more to come on that, I hope will become a case study for what is, after all, one of the most extraordinary fan bases. That's the value of the Lions. Is it's not the biggest, it's not the most global, but it's a very particular fan base. Howden want to know about them. So does Canterbury. If we get it right, we'll both get it. We'll both get what we need to make that commercial imperative of why we spent the money on the rights fees we did and make a turn on it. Because if we didn't, what was the point? And the whole sort of thrust of the conversation about rights holders just demanding and trying to put a gun to the head of sponsors and kit manufacturers, people saying, you just have to pay this because you do, that's not good enough anymore.
No. I wanted to thank you for organising that, Giles. One thing I wanted to ask you about extra before we go, we didn't get time at the top of the show. The whole bullying thing about the Aberdeen brand, you dropped your eye on that a couple of years ago and worked with them for a little bit. Tell us what your reaction is to the news that came out last week around how much heat Aberdeen are getting for that rebranding.
Yeah, I did. I spent a year working with the guys at Aberdeen. They had been both through Aberdeen Asset Management, which was one half of the previous business, had been sponsors, particularly in golf, and Standard Life, as they then were under a different ownership to the current Standard Life. It's a bit muddling, but had been very involved, I think, both in golf, but also particularly in rugby union. And as always with merged companies, the idea was to create a new brand. And again, insight would have been very helpful at that point in time. I think that rebrands are fine, and very often rebrands don't initially land, and then they do over time. I'm thinking of the London 2012 logo, which at the time when it was launched was met by media scorn, a bit like Aberdeen, but by the end of the Olympics was very much a beloved mark of the game. So they can work. But I sometimes think that in rebrand, what can happen is that the designers are given all of the decision-making process without the insight. And it's actually a very similar conversation to what we're talking about with Simon about sports and brands. And if you want to know what the consumer wants, you better find out what they do want. Otherwise, and if you think about asset management and you think about Standard Life, which I think, Rog, you'll know this as a Scot, is certainly one of Scotland's oldest companies. I think it's 200, 300
most
years
prestigious.
Old. Prestigious, part of one of the big Edinburgh businesses historically, of which that real heritage has, particularly when you're talking about money, has an enormous role to play in the protection of money and investment and so on. Aberdeen Asset Management, set up by Martin Gilbert, much newer company, but still, I think it had been 30 or 40 years old, and was a very respected business. Therefore, to muck around with it and say, right, well, we've got to come up with something without, you know, whether it's with vowels or not. I understand the design process and was actually not involved in the decision making, but was certainly saw a lot of the documentation. But I think it missed the one most important thing, which is, what do you think the customer who is putting their trust and their faith with their money in your business, how are they going to feel? And I don't know how they were going to feel, but I bet Aberdeen didn't know either. And it's sort of come home to bite them a bit, which it's easy to say in hindsight, maybe it could have stuck and maybe it could have worked. But my feeling is with brands, I'll give a lovely anecdote just to finish. And I think I'm allowed to say it. I left HSBC 7 years ago. You'll remember after the financial crisis, that British banks all had to ring fence. They all had to separate their brands out from their businesses because of what had happened with RBS and others. And whilst HSBC had not been affected at all by the downfall of some of the other banks because it was big and big in Asia, the government made the decision that those businesses had to separate. So there was great media kerfuffle, I suppose, about what would HSBC in the UK be called, because, you know, it had to be different from HSBC PLC, the holding company. And I remember the media was speculating, would Midland Bank be reincarnated, or was there going to be some other very, very fancy, and how much were the design agencies going to be paid, etc. And my old boss at HSBC, who was my boss for 12 or 13 years, one of the great, great brand marketeers, Chris Clark, retired now, just a phenomenal guy, smart as you like, knew brands better than anybody. I remember he pulled together a bunch of people in the bank, and he was a pragmatist as much as anything. And he said, I brought you a packet of biscuits from Sainsbury's or something like that. And he literally had the CEO, the chairman, the CFO, all of the big guns in a group. And he said, we could go down a rebrand route, if you like, but come on, let's have a cup of tea, cup of coffee, and some biscuits that I've bought you. He said, I've got an idea. How about we call it HSBC UK? and they all went, yeah, that's good. Yeah. He said, right, well, that saved you. That was a 79p packet of biscuits saved from 2 or 3 million quid on a rebrand, because we are HSBC. We are in the UK, ergo HSBC UK, which those of you with beady eyes will notice for the last 7 years, it's called HSBC UK. So the only point about that, I'm not knocking the branding agencies. They do an amazing and brilliant job. But I think sometimes insight, and again, assumption, insight, all of those things, if that's been the watchword of this week's show, is sometimes just ask people what they want first and you might get an answer that will lead you halfway there.
Yeah, that's a great way to finish, Giles. Thank you for that. I want to thank Web3 Sport Ventures for bringing this show to you. Without them, it wouldn't be possible. And it was great to hear that they're very much involved with what you guys are doing, and Simon as well. If you don't already follow us, you can follow us on Twitter. The official account is EntertainR, that's the word R.
And you can follow me, Giles Morgan, at Giles Morgan 71.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Roger, great fun. It's Sunday night. It's time for the Masters. Who will win? Well, we'll find out on football. We'll know by Thursday, but lovely to chat, and looking forward to speaking next time.
Yes, I'd just like to formally and seriously dedicate this episode to a wonderful lady called Frankie, a great fan of the show, a great woman of sport, and may she rest in peace.
Thank you, Roger.